You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Stanley Kubrick was unique among filmmakers in that he didn't specialize in any one particular genre. Rather, he liked to sample from all of them, like one would a craft beer flight, and deliver a final product that would serve as the gold standard within his respective genre. By the late 1970s, the horror genre was phenomenally popular, a reflection of turbulent, uncertain times, and a fundamental distrust of authority. Kubrick sensed his irrelevance within the horror genre, and sought to rectify the situation while bringing artistic legitimacy to otherwise schlocky fare. This meant finding subject matter that was completely different from the usual assortment of zombies, ghosts, and vampires. After poring through mountains of prospective material as per his custom, he found what he was looking for in The Shining, Stephen King's seminal novel about a man driven mad by the spooks residing in an old Colorado hotel. Kubrick was infamous for radically changing his films' source material, and his treatment of King's The Shining is perhaps the most egregious example of that. King's initial screenplay draft was thrown out by Kubrick, who disagreed with the author's supernatural-heavy take, and instead hired Diane Johnson to help him rework the story into a tale about malevolent energy and its effect on the human psyche. Working once again with his brother-in-law Jan Harlan as executive producer, Kubrick set about making his version of The Shining in England, a production that would bog down cast and crew for over a year while the director battled his way through the shoot's frequent and frustrating speed bumps. The final film initially met with lukewarm critical reception and a scathing dismissal from King himself. But Kubrick's hypnotic take on the horror genre would grow in esteem and infamy until it became considered as one of the master filmmaker's finest films, and, quite possibly, the scariest film of all time.
Has it ever occurred to you that I have agreed to look after the Overlook Hotel until May the 1st? Does it matter to you at all that the owners have placed their complete confidence and trust in me and that I have signed a letter of agreement, a contract, in which I have accepted that responsibility? Do you have the slightest idea what a moral and ethical principle is, do you? Has it ever occurred to you what would happen to my future if I were to fail to live up to my responsibilities? Has it ever occurred to you? Has it?
Stay away from me.
Why?
I just want to go back to my room.
Why?
Well, I'm very confused.
The Shining isn't the first time that actor Jack Nicholson crossed Kubrick's orbit. The director previously had Nicholson in mind to play the titular role of Napoleon in his failed passion project. Instead, Nicholson makes his Kubrick debut here as Jack Torrance, the frustrated protagonist turned antagonist.
Hi, Lloyd. A little slow tonight, isn't it?
An actor well known for his brilliantly unhinged performances, Nicholson turns in perhaps the best work of his career by channeling a fundamental twitchiness, as if he's uncomfortable in his own body. His spiraling psychosis is at once both riveting and terrifying to witness.
I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
You did this to him, didn't you?
Shelley Duvall is also effective as the ineffectual, meek, and needy wife to Nicholson, a woman whose mundane blandness is almost oppressively so. Duvall famously had a rough time on the production, where Kubrick tormented her with constant verbal abuse.
No, I can't.
Yeah, but when
hear.
You came out like this, you said it is. But
we're sitting there because they say, wait
yeah,
a minute,
okay.
And then you say
yeah.
on the radio,
but when you
go.
Do it, you've got to look desperate, Shelley. You're just wasting everybody's time there.
I can't even get this
well,
door open.
Well,
if it was all done to get a certain performance out of Duvall, it certainly worked. Duvall's exhausted shakiness projects a hopeless demeanor that adds to the film's overall tension. As the young, innocent Danny Torrance, Danny Lloyd doesn't fall prey to overacting, the bane of all child actors. And it is precisely this restraint which makes his Red Rum trance so bone-chilling and memorable.
Stop it!
Red Rum!
Danny!
Red Rum!
Red Rum!
For supporting cast, Kubrick reunites with a couple familiar faces, Philip Stone and Joe Turkel. In his third consecutive appearance for Kubrick, Stone assumes the persona of Delbert Grady, the ghostly waiter of the Gold Room, whose distant politeness and manner is uncomfortably creepy.
My girls, sir, they didn't care for the Overlook at first. One of them actually stole a pack of matches and tried to burn it down. But I corrected them, sir.
Turkel, who last worked with Kubrick on 1957's Paths of Glory, plays Lloyd, the Gold Room's bartender. Turkel is particularly inspired casting, as his gaunt visage already resembles that of a skull. Turkel adopts an emotionless, painted-on smile that sears itself into our retinas, like a morbid Cheshire cat. Scatman Crothers, who used his friendship with Nicholson to get into the casting room, plays the Overlook's head chef, Dick Halloran. Crothers' role is an important one, as he shares Danny's ability to shine, and explains the phenomenon to the young boy, and by extension, explains the title to the audience.
I can remember when I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining.
The Shining marks Kubrick's third consecutive collaboration with director of photography John Alcott, and their groundbreaking work together on Barry Lyndon translates here into a horror movie that looks unlike any other. Beginning with the sweeping, rock-steady helicopter shot that opens the film with the majesty of the Rocky Mountains, Kubrick and Alcott immediately signal to us that this won't just be another cobwebs and candelabras creep show. The Shining, perhaps more so than any other Kubrick film, features the near-constant use of one-point perspective compositions, which imbues the 35mm film frame with an evocative sense of depth. By setting up the Overlook Hotel as a three-dimensional space, Kubrick and Alcott then introduce the idea of exploring every nook and cranny via their camera. While The Shining features lots of conventional dolly camera work, its legacy lies in its introduction of Garrett Brown's Steadicam rig to audiences. Kubrick was fascinated by the organic yet serenely smooth nature of Brown's groundbreaking camera innovation, and he uses the technique here almost as if it were its own character. Indeed, many of the shots in The Shining give us a distinct sense that a foreboding, unseen entity, or even the hotel itself, is alive and watching the Torrances' every move. Instead of relying on the gothic imagery of horror films past, Kubrick employs the Steadicam to generate the film's unnerving creepiness. His expertise with various lenses also helped him considerably as far as this new tech was concerned. By placing an extremely wide lens on the Steadicam, he could create an exaggerated sense of momentum, speed, and gravity, which served to better place the audience in the point of view of malevolent, ethereal entities. Also returning to the Kubrick fold is musician Wendy Carlos, who teams up with Rachel Elkin to deliver The Shining score. This being a Kubrick film, their work isn't necessarily comprised of new original cues. Rather, Carlos and Elkin appropriate and manipulate dark existing works from contemporary classical artists, weaving them into a foreboding tapestry that underlies and enhances Kubrick's images. Most of the film's music is filtered through the prism of a Moog synthesizer, previously used to equally chilling effect in A Clockwork Orange. The electronic synths are worked into an ominous music bed, peppered with disembodied chanting voices and the rhythm of a throbbing heartbeat. Perhaps the most recognizable aspect of The Shining's musical soundscape, however, is the use of the Ray Noble Orchestra's vintage recording of a slow love ballad called Midnight, the Stars, and You. Used in the background of the scene where Jack may or may not be hallucinating a 1920s-era ball, it gives us a peek into the glamour of the Overlook's heyday while underscoring the tragedies that doomed it to ruin. Kubrick was a master of ironic song choices that served as counterpoints to the images they accompany, and his juxtaposition here of a glamorous old-fashioned love ballad, echoing in the foreboding emptiness of the Overlook, creates an irony that is distinctly chilling. A significant reason of why The Shining has endured over the decades within a genre that seeks to top itself with every new entry is Kubrick's inclusion of heavily coded visuals and cues. The Overlook Hotel is presented as a giant puzzle that requires multiple viewings to solve, a reflection of Kubrick's own love for the intellectual stimulation provided by chess. A documentary film released in 2013, Room 237, examines the various interpretations and hidden messages inherent in The Shining. These conspiracy theories, for lack of a better term, range from the reasonably sound, like the film being a metaphor for the genocide of the Native Americans, to the utterly ridiculous, like the film being Kubrick's confession that he faked the moon landing for NASA. The documentary itself is well worth watching to see all the various interpretations of meaning that The Shining has given birth to since its release, but two interpretations in particular bear legitimate explorations. Ever since Nicholson uttered the line,
"White man's burden, Lloyd, my man. White man's burden."
Academics and fans alike have drawn allusions from Kubrick's film to the massacre of the Native Americans. The Overlook is stuffed with Native American imagery, from decorative quilts to the cans of Calumet baking powder that line the stockroom. This interpretation was first popularized in 1987 by former ABC reporter Bill Blakemore in an essay entitled Kubrick's Shining Secret, where he points to the closing image of Nicholson's face among the revelers in a photograph of the Overlook's 1921 July 4th ball. He writes, "Most Americans overlook the fact that July 4th was no ball, nor any kind of Independence Day for Native Americans. That the weak American villain of the film is the re-embodiment of the American men who massacred the Indians in earlier years. That Kubrick is examining and reflecting on a problem that cuts through decades and centuries." The second interpretation that suggests The Shining as a massive puzzle is the inconsistent and conflicting layout and geography of the Overlook itself. King famously modeled the novel's version on the infamous Stanley Hotel in Colorado, a purported hive of paranormal activity and spectral spooks. Like he did with King's story, Kubrick rejected King's suggestion to shoot at the Stanley in favor of his own design, basing it on the Timberline Lodge situated at the peak of Oregon's Mount Hood. Kubrick shows us the Timberline in wide shot during bright daylight towards the beginning of the film, allowing us an unadulterated, extended glimpse of it. This isn't merely an establishing shot, however. It's the setup of an extremely subtle deception on Kubrick's part. For the rest of the exterior scenes, Kubrick built a condensed-scale version of the Timberline's facade outside a soundstage in England. The effect is a hotel exterior that looks the same upon first glance, but under closer scrutiny reveals dramatic inconsistencies. This approach extends to the interiors, all built on a soundstage in such a way that allows Kubrick to run a steadicam through its grand halls, residential corridors, and industrial kitchen spaces seamlessly. What we don't realize as an audience, however, is that if one were to map the layout of Kubrick's Overlook on a sheet of paper, and many have done so, one would find an impossible geography pockmarked by dead-end corridors, windows where there should be walls, and other curiosities. Kubrick's Overlook is like one of those haunted house mazes where the door disappears behind you the moment you enter the room. Architectural design aesthetics vary wildly from room to room, creating a mishmash of jarring colors and styles from drastically different time periods. By rendering the Overlook in such a way, Kubrick is subtly suggesting that the hotel itself is a living, breathing entity of evil that exists outside of normal space-time. The Shining, more so than any other film in his filmography, illustrates one aspect of Kubrick's work that becomes clear only in retrospect, a recurring motif that incorporates imagery from the Greek myth of the Minotaur and the Labyrinth. Mazes, labyrinths, and tunnels play a huge role in shaping Kubrick's aesthetic worldview. Ever since he sent a camera careening down a narrow New York City street in Killer's Kiss, Kubrick has made potent use of the tunnel as a visual allegory. There's also another allusion to the Greek myth in Killer's Kiss in the form of the opening credit that reads A Minotaur Production, the name of Kubrick's production company at the time. This could hardly be construed as coincidental, especially when such similar tunnel imagery appears in Paths of Glory's Embattled Trenches, or 2001's claustrophobic spaceship Corridors. Kubrick's protagonists always seem to be descending into an underworld of sorts, where they will have to confront a supernatural enemy. The Shining is easily Kubrick's most overt reference to the Greek myth, what with the long, languid takes that roam the Overlook's countless nooks and crannies. He even places the climax inside a literal maze, just in case we were incapable of picking up on his earlier signals.
Little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
The horror genre serves Kubrick well in his explorations of sex and violence, allowing him to indulge in more lurid meditations of each. See Jack's psychotic axe murder spree, or the ghostly naked woman in Room 237, or even this fundamentally unnerving shot. The Shining is no doubt a film about a man's swift downward spiral into madness, but Kubrick's particular ideas about the fragility of the human psyche make for an utterly original film that bears his unmistakable stamp. He never quite tells us what exactly is causing the hotel's unexplainable phenomena. Are these ghosts simply a manifestation of Jack's growing psychosis, or are they authentically supernatural? Michael Chement, a leading Kubrick scholar, has pointed out in his writings that whenever Jack converses with the ghosts of the Overlook, he is always situated so that he is talking into a mirror. This would seem to definitely suggest that Lloyd the bartender and Grady the waiter are simply manifestations of Jack's psychological state. But then later on in the film, Grady is depicted physically releasing Jack from the meat locker that Wendy's trapped him inside.
You give your word on that deal, Mr. Torrance?
I give you my word.
When this happens, we're forced to admit that the real source of the Overlook's evil is ultimately unknowable. This is where the true horror of The Shining lies. The Shining is held in such high regard today that it's easy to forget that Kubrick's first and only horror film was not well received when it was initially released. Critical reviews were unfavorable, and box office receipts were lackluster before the film picked up steam quite some time afterwards. In setting out to conquer the horror genre, Kubrick created an enduring classic that continues not only to chill us to the bone, but to awe us with its impeccable craftsmanship. Very few horror films can be rightfully called masterpieces, but The Shining is just that, a stunning, reference-grade work of cinema that dares to show us that true horror comes from within.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by your generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.